I'm an alcoholic, member of the Westside Men's Group.
Nice.
And my name is Rob.
Hey, Rob.
It's actually shocking to me and extremely gratifying to be asked to speak in front of a group of guys like yourselves. I didn't know what to say when he asked me. I told him, don't worry, I'm not nervous at all. I definitely lied right then. And he gave me about 3 or 4 hours to think about it, you know, so that definitely didn't help either. In that 3 or 4 hours, I was trying to think of different things that I wanted to talk about. Whether I was going to tell a story of what it was like or try to explain what it's like now. But this retreat has been extremely special for me. You know, not only is it my first retreat that I've ever been on, I've been in recovery. I've been around recovery for 8 years. I had a relapse for 4 months. That's when I lost my scooter. I'll get that out of the way. And I've been sober about 5.5 years since I lost that scooter. So thank God that scooter went missing. I never went on a retreat. I didn't really do conventions. I had some guys that I hung around, and I learned a lot of things, and I'm extremely grateful for those guys. But it came a time in my life and my recovery where things had to expand. And I got a new sponsor. I came back to Westside Men's Group because Westside Men's Group was my first AA meeting that I've ever been to. But when I walked into that room and I seen all you guys, I said, no way will I ever relate to any of these people. You know, you guys were completely different than me. You know, you look like you had your shit together. You know, I'm like, you know, I'm just not gonna relate. And today I look around this room and there are so many people that have been instrumental in my life. A lot of them because they guided me, they gave me suggestions and spoke to me and really helped me make decisions on how to better my life and get me to where I am today. And others by the way you walk, the way you talk, and how you what you do in and outside of the meetings, you know. I grew up an observer, right? I didn't have the traditional parents, okay? I grew up in Philadelphia, all right? And my mom and my dad, they met each other in a treatment center. So they got married, had 2 kids, and lived happily ever after. I spilled a little wine on my sweatshirt, and I came to AA. Isn't that how the story normally goes? I bet you that's what they thought how it was gonna go. How many times have we seen that? Things didn't go well. Things were not good in my household. My grandparents were pretty much the people who raised me. My mom continued to use drugs, and my dad went to jail for murder very shortly after I was born. So I didn't really know him. So I got in a lot of trouble. I didn't really have any guidance. I didn't have anyone to tell me no. So I ran rapid through the town. By the time I was 12 years old, I was already arrested a few times. You know, 15 years old, I did 2.5 years juvie life until I was 18. And it was that way until I was about 33 years old. It was when I finally got off of paper. You know, I was either on the run, in jail, or on paper that entire time from 12 to 33. So, I say that just so you get a little bit of an idea of where I came from, all right? And what it was like, you know, what happened and what it's like now. I look around this room and I know a lot of you guys. I hear your stories. You tell me these things. It's the stories that we tell, our experience, our stories are our greatest asset, right? And when I first got the impression looking at you guys when I walked into that meeting the first time, I told myself that I could never relate. But the truth is that I relate to each and every one of you on an individual scale, right? And the one thing that we all have in common is that we had a problem with alcohol or drugs or some other substance, right? And also the feeling and the thinking that we felt. That's what binds us. And in my perception, in the way, my opinion, I believe that each and every one of us are miracles, right? Every one of us. And when I look at my life today, there's no other explanation than it was a miracle. Okay? So if there is a topic, it basically is, you know, the miracle of AA, you know, how it was all put together. It's just, we were talking about it earlier. It's, I believe, divinely inspired and a true gift. So, you know, I don't want to dive too much into what happened because there's a lot of it. What it was like, there's a lot of it. But it was 2015. Things got really, really bad. I was 35 years old. Things started to get bad for me. You know, I lost my house. Well, I got evicted. I didn't lose it. It was right there. It's still there. You know, I got evicted. Let's keep it real, right? I got evicted because I didn't pay my rent, the son of a bitch. And then my car gets stolen, and then I find out I have some heart disease, and you know, it's like a serious thing apparently to have a heart disease, and I got to do this surgery, and like, you know, it was about a 4 or 5 month span where all these things were happening, and then within that, my mom, who never got sober, you know, one night got all messed up, you know, passed out with a cigarette in her hand, lit the mattress on fire, and then she died in that fire. So, you know, for what it's worth, she was never really, you know, I'm just being honest, right? She wasn't the best mom, you know, but she was the only mom that I had. So, you know, we talked about this too this weekend, you know. I found a place today where I know that my mother did the best she could with what she had, you know, just, you know, we do the best we can. And not all of us are as lucky to experience this miracle, you know. And it was introduced to my mom, but she chose not to take advantage of it, you know. And but because of that, you know, I used to look at these things, you know, I hated God, I hated people. I was extremely angry. It was a very dark time in my life. And I used to think it was the worst thing. Like, how could God do this to me? Right? It was the worst thing that could ever happen to me. Here I am 8 years later standing in front of you guys. So how bad was it? You know, everything happens for a reason. I believe God uses all things for good, you know. And even though it was extremely painful, we're talking about that pain is a touchstone to all spiritual progress. And that was a lot of pain that I had to go through to get me to where I went. Upon coming here to Florida, I had a friend of mine. We grew up together, hung out all the time. I mean, we did a lot of the same things. And he wasn't at my mother's funeral, and I was wondering why. So he calls me up one day, and he tells me that he went to treatment. And I was like, well, that's really good because you needed it. And I didn't mean it. And he tells me he went to treatment and that he's in the halfway house and he's in Florida. And, you know, I'm like, well, okay, how is it? And he's like, no offense. Oh, man, they put it on the internet. They made it look all nice, but it's not what it was supposed to be. And, you know, he was just like angry. He hated it, right? He hated it. He didn't want to be there. So, you know, I'm doing some things and I sort of need his help to complete this task that I have come up with. And I said, well, when are you coming back? He said, in about a week. I said, perfect. I'll wait until then. I'm right by the airport. I'll pick you up when you get there. And a week goes by and he ends up calling me. And he says, I'm perfect timing. Where are you at? You at the airport? I'll come get you. And he's like, no, I'm still in Florida. I was like, well, when are you getting on the plane? He's like, I don't think I am. I'm like, well, why not? He's like, I don't know, man. I think I might stick it out for a little while. I said, well, why the hell would you do that? You know? And this is the moment where things started to change for me. You know? He said something to me that he wasn't supposed to say. All right? He said something to me that we don't talk about. This is not supposed to be said between two people like us. He said, I think I found God. I said, get the hell, you gotta be kidding me. And I'm trying to watch my language. That's not what I said, but it sounded something like that. And I'm like, you know, what does that even mean? What are you talking about? Long story short, for the next 3 days, I didn't really sleep. You know, I couldn't really do anything. I was just stuck in this thought, like, why would he say that? I think the meth sort of helped to keep me up, you know? Might have had something to do with it, a little bit. But my gears were turning, you know? My gears were turning. And it was like that little bit of the little bit of the seed was planted that day in my mind. You know, if this degenerate person that I'm talking to on the other end of this phone can say something like that to me, there has to be something out there better than what I was doing. And about 3 days later, I ended up in Florida in a halfway house. And I hated it. I mean, I hated it. I was freaking miserable. People were walking around smiling all the time. And, you know, I just wanted to punch them right in their face. I couldn't stand them. But I would sit outside of the apartment there in this little white chair. And this guy would walk by me every day. And he would say, you know, it's going to get better. You know, I said, okay. And he walked by the next day. It's going to get better. I'm like, okay. He walks by the next day. He says, it's going to get better. I said, if it doesn't get better, I'm going to kick your ass first because I'm dying here. Things started to get better. I started to feel better, you know. I wouldn't necessarily say that my mind started to clear up and I started thinking better. A lot of the same thoughts were there, and that was talked about today too. You know, it takes a lot more than just stop using drugs and alcohol for the mind to clear up and for you actually to find some type of peace and happiness. And that was something that I didn't experience yet. I was sitting in the meeting one night. It was a Monday. It was anniversary night. And this lady gets up and she starts talking about, you know, she's got her 5-year medallion and she's doing all this. And I'm like, yeah, all right. I didn't believe that anyone was really sober. You know, they were probably smoking weed in the parking lot or had a couple drinks here and there. But she says something. She's like, don't leave until the miracle happens, you know. And that was something that I've heard before, but this time I just heard it different. It just, it resonated in me because I knew that my entire life I had done just that. I had left before any type of good could come into my life. As soon as something started to get bad or it was something I didn't like, I ran away or I kicked it to the curb. You know, I can never stick around long enough for things to actually get better in my life. You know, and so after that, I figured, you know, maybe I'll give this thing a shot. As I started to, you know, I got a sponsor, started to go through the steps. I started to gain a better understanding of what was going on here, you know. I really tried and practiced this program to the best of my ability at that time. But somebody told me and said, the things you love most about yourself are the same exact things that are trying to kill you, you know? And I was like, you don't know what you're talking about. And the thing that I loved most about myself was myself, you know? I liked to have an ego. I liked it. I liked to feel superior than other people. I wanted to be better. I wanted to win the argument. I would one-up you, I would lie. I would lie and say I did something just to make me better than you, you know? And that wasn't the truth. So this went on for a while. And I ended up staying sober for about 2.5 years. And my sponsor said to me, if you don't get rid of your ego, you're going to die. And I said, you don't know what you're talking about. I told him to go kick rocks. I stopped going to meetings. I stopped sponsoring people. And a little while after that, I was drinking. And as soon as I started drinking, you know, my sponsor, my old sponsor used to say in the meeting statement, you know, keep your shares to your problem with alcohol. He's like, my problem with alcohol is every time I drank alcohol, I wanted to do crack. I mean, sorry, but that's what he said, not me. That was, you know, disclosure here. And So, and that was me too, you know? So one follows the other, peanut butter and jelly, and I'm off to the races, you know? And it was an absolute nightmare. But no one, I didn't want to come back in with my head down, tail tucked between my legs, saying like, I messed up, you know? So I stayed out. I mean, it lasted 4 months, and then I lost my scooter and had to tell my boss, sorry, I'm late to work because I lost my scooter. And I knew at that moment that, if I kept going, I was going to end up right back in that hotel room, you know? At least I got that. So I called my sponsor back up and I started to actually, I told him, you know, I said, can you help me again? But at that moment, I don't even know if I wanted to help because he kept asking me to do stuff, you know? He kept asking me to do these things, like be a good person and stuff. And I was like, you know, snapped. I said, I'm not the person you think I am. I'm not no goody two shoe, khaki wearing, you know, penny loafers. That's not me, you know? That ain't me. So just stop trying to make me out to be what you want me to be. And I hung up on him. I jumped back on my new scooter and I rode home. I got home and I looked over in the mirror. And I just couldn't hold it in anymore. I just started bawling, crying, you know? And I knew if I kept going in this way, if I kept fighting everything and everyone, that I would end up right back where I was. That hotel room was just one decision away. Just one decision away, you know? So I called him back and I told him, I'm not gonna fight you anymore, you know? I made a promise to him, he didn't believe me, but I believed me at that moment. That I'm not gonna fight you anymore. I'm gonna do what you tell me to do. And I started to listen. I went through the books again. You know, and I say books because I read a lot of books, you know, the big book, the original, love it. 12 and 12, awesome, all right? Drop the Rock, Ripple Effect, you know, and we just kept reading books, more and more books. I finally read one that literally changed my life. It's not necessarily AA approved, but a lot of people in AA read it. And Cliff was talking about it, the delusion of our minds, and it says it throughout our books. In the first step of the 12 and 12, it says, we have warped our minds into such an obsession for destructive drinking that only an act of providence could relieve it from us, right? I like to change that up and say, warped our minds into such an obsession for destructive thinking, you know, because that's who I was. Every time I made these decisions to pick up and to use, I was completely sober right before I did it. Well, most of the time. Sometimes one ran into the other, but for the most part, right? I was completely sober. So I need to do these things. I need to work on these things. I need to learn these things to help me. I read that book and it talked about the delusion and these agreements that we pick up, right, from the world and from our parents and from our friends and environment and things that we have learned and that we believe are true 100%. You know, I believed that how I thought was reality, you know, and it wasn't. It was a false reality. It wasn't until I could start being honest with myself. You know, the first principle, the first step is honesty. Well, who am I being honest with? If I'm being honest with you, but I'm still lying to myself, how am I ever going to get any help? You know, I had to be honest with myself. You know, one time my sponsor told me, I don't know who you think you are. You know, you think you're this big shot. You ride a scooter. You don't have a license. You live in a little efficiency, you know, and that was harsh. I was like, damn, dude. You know, my feelings were hurt. And when I really looked at it, I mean, I rode a scooter. I lived in an efficiency, you know. I didn't have a license. I didn't have a license for 22 years, you know. So, you know, I had to really take this look at myself and discover who I was and who I wasn't, right? Sometimes it's who we aren't that is holding us up. So I dove into these books, I started to read, I started to do these things, and, you know, lo and behold, who knew? You follow the directions, you get a better result than taking the shortcut, You know, I like to think of it like getting a bed from IKEA. What's the first thing we do when we get a bed from IKEA?
Call Dave.
Call Dave. Well, what's the first thing that Dave does? He opens the box, grabs the instructions, throws it to the side, says, "I got this." Right? And that's what I've been doing my whole life. People have been giving me the instructions the whole time. I've had help. I've had opportunities. I'd like to blame it on everyone and everything else. My problems were not my fault. But every time I pointed the finger, I had three fingers pointed back at me. All right? And it wasn't until I started to follow the instructions. All right? Take the instructions out. All right? First step, unwrap A and B. Boom. It's simple. It's simple. I started following the instructions, and lo and behold, my life started to get better. You know, and better. And better. And better. You know, I don't want to sit up here and take too much time. Sometimes I can talk a lot. But my life today is so much further along than it has ever been in my entire life. It's unexplainable. You know, I've been talking this weekend with a couple of people. You know, I've been able to get my license back. All right. Now these are the outside stuff. All right. I got my license back. I got a house. I got a job. I'm getting promotions. I have friends. I got people that care about me. You know, I have things today that I never had before. The most important thing that I have today, that sobriety has given me, when I look in the mirror, I like myself. But not like myself like you the man. You know, it's not that. Well, sometimes, maybe sometimes. All right, take it easy. I forgot who I was talking to. If it was a different group, they wouldn't believe me. But, you know, I like who I'm becoming, right? And it's not the khaki wearing, although I have worn khakis a few times. But I have not put on penny loafers. Maybe when I go to church, I put on penny loafers. But no, I haven't put them on yet. But who knows? And the thing is one thing I didn't know is what I actually liked. You know, I had this vision, this perception of who I was and what I like and who I am. And it turns out today, I'm nothing like any of that. You know, I care about people. I truly care about people. You know, I've been privileged to be a part of this. It just, I don't want to get emotional and everything up here, but it has been the greatest gift that has ever been given to me. You know, I think about the reading, why we were chosen, you know, and why I was chosen to get this. You know, why not my mom? Why not my buddy Sween? You know, the guy who got me down here, he decided to take his will back, went back out. For like one day, sniffed one line of heroin and never woke up, you know? So, you know, why? And, you know, I think I'm gonna be honest, you know, I'm not gonna sit up here and say that I'm perfect by any means, you know, I'm still new to this. I look around and it's like, you guys have so much of what I want. So many of you guys have been in this program for a long time. And you're really good examples of what I want to be when I grow up, you know. But I ask myself sometimes, you know, why? Why was I chosen? Why am I still here? I shouldn't be. I was worse than all of them. And most of them. Stevie was pretty big. And some of these things are only answered, should only be in the mind of God himself. It's not my business why I was chosen. My business is to be of maximum service to God and my fellows. And that is it today. 100%. I wake up every single morning. I remind myself who I am. I have something on First Step Commitment that tells me exactly who I am. And that allows me to do the things necessary to become who I could be. Page 58, 12 and 12. The definition of humility, a clear recognition of who and what we truly are, followed by a sincere attempt to become what we could be. You know, and that's what I'm doing. If that's humility, and to thine own self be true, could be a part of humility, then that's what I'm seeking today. You know, and thank you, Robert. Thank you for choosing me to sit up here today, because in the back of my mind, there's a part of me that feels like it shouldn't be me, you know? But hell, if I could sit up here, then there's definitely any single person in this room could be doing the same. Thank you very much.
My name's Mike, I'm an alcoholic. So let's see, my sobriety date's May 1st, 1997. And it took me that long to come and visit this group of guys. Amazing. I guess I'll qualify myself. I'm a drunk, no doubt about it. There was never any doubt about it. I lied about it forever, but there was no doubt about it. I came into this program as a, product of the Broward County court system. I was very nicely invited to come here and stay here. I actually kind of told me I had to, but and that was my introduction to this place. It's a product of collecting up 3 DUIs in 9 weeks. I'd love to tell you guys that those were the only three. I'd be lying my ass off if I said that. Now, there's a lot more than just three. And there's a lot more states and all kinds of things. Location, location, location. We were talking about that earlier. I traveled around a lot. Keep running from the cops and keep running from the law, and you just run around. That's all. And just not get caught. But I ended up down here in Fort Lickerdale. And that was another plane trip of quick get out of town. I came down on vacation, looked around, stayed down at Ball Harbor, got drunk on the beach all day, and like, this is beautiful, right? So I landed down here. My brother said, just come down and come stay with me. And he lived downtown by the courthouse next to the railroad tracks in this dumpy little apartment above a garage. And that was my welcome to Fort Lauderdale. That place burned down like overnight while I was in it. Quick dive out the back window. I didn't set the fire, guys. So it wasn't me. It was the guy next door who was collecting insurance. So, but I ran around down here like crazy. And as soon as I got off the plane, the very first thing he did was take me to Summers on the Beach. Not go unload your bags at the house, get cleaned up, you're ready, we'll go out, we'll go have some fun. No. Airport, Summers on the Beach. From there up to the candy store. In the meantime, March or something like that when I moved down here. I decided it's a good idea while you're all nice and drunk to run across the street, go jump in the ocean, go swimming around. I'm nice and warm. I didn't know it's freezing down here and everybody else is cold and they're all looking at me funny and I'm like, yeah, so what, But that's the way everything was running. I was just running around on fire and having a blast down here. So I thought I was having a blast. The longer I was down here, the more DUIs I was collecting up, the more time I was spending in taxpayer dollars. And that's the way that was going on. And there was a while where I was in jail more than I was out. And I still didn't think that I had a problem. I just thought I was unlucky, wrong place, wrong time, how all of that goes. And it wasn't until I got those 3 DUIs that, first one was out driving around, and sure enough, get pulled over by the cops. The next one was a funny one because I was already parked in a sicko gas station and the guy made me walk home and told me, do not, under any circumstances, come back and pick up this car. I waited for about an hour, went back over, parked the car back in a driveway. The next morning, they came over, him and another cop, dragged me out of my doorway where I was sitting there having a cigar, wanted me to do a field test, sobriety test, and I said, what for? Because we're arresting you for a DUI. I said, I haven't driven anywhere. It's in the morning. I'm sitting here having a cigar. Yeah, you were driving. And both of them swore to it, and I went down. Third one, I run into the back of this little car out drunk driving. I mean, when I say I'm not drinking and driving, no, I was drunk driving. And I'm out in the neighborhood. I have no idea where I am. I run to the back of this little Volkswagen thing. Lady comes running around the car, digs a baby out of the back seat, and she's just sitting there screaming at me. My best thinking at that moment, of course, I got to get out of here, right? So I get back in the car, and I'm trying to swing around. This is 1996, no, beginning of 1997. Nobody's got cell phones. There's none of that stuff, right? There's a guy standing over on the side of the road with a cell phone in his hand. He's already called the cops. Before I can even get this land yacht that I'm driving around in, before I can even swing around a corner and start heading down the street, I was already surrounded, and I'm going down. And of course, now it's leaving the scene, plus all the things that go along with that. I'm out on bail for the first one. Then I get a second bailout on that one, and I'm trying to call up my boss who had bailed me out on the first two to please come and get me out of this. God, if you just get me out of this, I will do something. You know the foxhole prayer, the one we all say. If you just get me out of this, I'll do something. I have no idea what something is yet, but I'll do something. So I'm trying to call through, And you know how those collect phone calls go? So this is a collect call from the Broward County Correctional Institution. Will you please accept? Click. And I kept trying every chance I would get, and they'd turn the phones on for you. I'd try calling again, click. One last phone call, the secretary picks up the phone call. She goes, what more do you want? And I said, I just need some help. If you get me out of here, I'll go get help. I'll do whatever it takes. I'll go to detox. I don't even know what detox is yet, but I'll go there. Sounds great. I can do a detox. Sure. Gets me out on a third bond. I have no idea how he got me out on the second one, let alone a third one, but he got me out. So go back to the shop, call up the insurance company. I've got a good job. I've got insurance. I'm not one of those guys that was like the dumpster diving drunks. I always had money. You know, I always had a good job. Keeping the jobs and stuff wasn't my problem. I was real good at it. They paid me well. They liked what I did. I made them money. I just couldn't stay sober, you know, and eventually, like all good jobs on earth, most of them went by the wayside. But I said, look, I'm going to do whatever it takes. So I called up the insurance company. They're like, no problem. We'll get you into a detox in 72 hours and we'll come and get you. 72 hours. So I locked myself in my apartment for 72 hours, and the secretary would bring me pizza and soda and cigarettes. And that's how I survived for 3 days. Steady diet, right, Andy? Yeah. See? So then I go to this detox, and the only thing that I could tell you about detox is I slept for 72 hours in there. I slept straight. I don't remember really getting up. I don't remember going anywhere, doing anything. I think I remember this meeting on a couch for a little while, but I don't know, it was kind of foggy. And, you know, next thing I know, there's a nurse coming in, and she's going, Mr. Livesey, it's okay, it's time for you to go now. And I'm looking at her like, even in the fog that I'm in right this minute, and trust me, fog is a pretty good word for it, I knew that if I walked out of that place, I was gonna drink again. It wasn't gonna take me long. I had a pocket full of cash. I got a sicko gas station across the street from me. Big Daddy's is right down the street. I'm out, you know, it'll take me moments. And so I'm sitting there and I'm begging and I'm pleading. And finally they find me this place in Miami. And so a guy comes and picks me up, takes me down to Miami, takes me down to this three-quarter house thing that I'm gonna be living in for a while. And I walk inside and I can't understand a word of what's going on. I don't speak Spanish. I'm a hillbilly boy from the mountains of New York. I don't understand anything of what's going on. I don't even know what the hell we're talking about at all, period. There's this one guy that speaks kind of broken English, and so I made a deal with him. I'll pay for all the cigarettes and soda and everything we need. You got to go to the store. Because if I walked down to that store, game over. I wouldn't walk out of the house. In my deluded mind, I knew that if I didn't do something and do it right, and I had to go up in front of a judge pretty soon, I was going away for a while. You don't collect up three DUIs in 9 weeks and not go somewhere for an extended stay vacation. And I'm guessing it wasn't one of those nice, sweet hotels on the side of the road. So I go do all of this stuff, and then they make you go to these meetings, you know, where you sit down in a group, and in this group, there's 30 guys in there, guys and girls. It was one of those things. And so I'm sitting there, and he's would go through his whole spiel, and he'd have the talk, and in the end of it, you go, well, one in 30 of you is going to make it to your first year in sobriety. One in 30. Which one of you is it going to be? I got DT so bad, I'm shaking like a leaf. I can't hold on a cup of coffee. I got to drink it through a straw. And I'm sitting in the back of this room, like that guy right there, and I'm sitting right by the door because in case anything goes wrong, gone, right? And every time I would raise my hand, and every time he'd go, and he would just do that. And after a while, I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, why not me? Why any of those guys? Why not me? Why is he looking at me like that? And I would sit there, and every single time it was the same thing. And I don't know if he knew something I didn't know. I don't know if maybe he was trying to do it out of spite, that if he gave me a hard enough time, maybe then I would do it. But I managed to get through that part. Then all of a sudden it's like, well, okay, we're going to move you up to this halfway house. Now you can go back to work. But it also means that now I got to go get on a bus and go from Hollywood to Fort Lauderdale to go to work, Fort Lauderdale all the way down to Miami, and then Miami back to Hollywood, and that was every single day riding on a bus. Well, that's humiliating, but I did it. Didn't understand what humility meant back then. That was humiliating. That's a different story. And, you know, but I did it. I did what it took, and I stayed in there, and I did the deal. And while I'm staying at this halfway house, somebody gave me a book, and it was the most important thing anybody had given to me at that point in time. And it's a little where and when. And in this little where and when is a list of all the meetings in Broward County. So I'm thumbing through this thing, and I'm thumbing through it, and I'm thumbing through it. Bikers in recovery. And I'm saying, bikers in recovery. Bikers, I understand just fine. I've known bikers my whole life. It's a beautiful thing. Bikers in recovery, no such thing. Two words that are not synonymous with each other. Doesn't go. And so, you know, I looked it all up, and sure enough, it's right down the street. So I walked my happy little ass down the street because I had walked in meetings because, of course, you can't drive anymore, you know. Not that I was supposed to be driving then, but I'm really not supposed to be driving now. So I go down to this meeting, and, of course, I sat in the back like that guy right there. Yeah. And right by the door, in case anything goes wrong, out the door I go. And I'm sitting back there, and a guy named Justin comes up, and he's chairing the meeting, and he's got a guy sitting next to him, and the guy goes up there, and, you know, he's telling his story. And I'm sitting there, and I'm listening, and this guy, he's talking about me. And I love AA. AA is a program of attraction. It's a beautiful thing. And that guy had me. He was sitting there telling my story. It was his story, just sounded a lot like mine. A lot of the same kind of circumstances, all the same stuff. And at the end of every meeting, Justin would stand up and he'd look around and go, okay, so would anybody like to share? And he's like, you in the back with the white shirt with the fish on it and in the khaki pants. I lived on Las Olas for a little while, and I thought that, you know, if I lived on Las Olas, I would drink with people on Los Solis and I would be more like them and it would be, you know, I'd be okay. I wouldn't drink the way that I drank normally. The only thing I found out about Los Solis Boulevard is that the scotch is very expensive and it costs a lot to live there. That's all I learned, nothing else. And I would just sit back there and I'd go, just kind of put my head down. No, I'm good, you know, I'm good. But it had me just enough to keep coming back. And I would come back to that meeting and it would, same thing. Another guy sitting up there sharing my story. And it wasn't exactly the same, but it was little bits and pieces of the same thing. So at the end of the month, Justin, you know, it was his last day up there, and he stands up at the end of the meeting. He's like, "What did anybody like to share?" "You in the back." Mm-hmm. And I stood up and I said, "My name's Mike. I'm an alcoholic. I have a problem and I need help." And for the very first time in my life, I meant it. You see, I always kind of knew I was an alcoholic. It was just always, if I'm going to be an alcoholic, I'm going to be the best damn alcoholic anybody's ever seen. And I drank exactly that way. I blackout drank every single time I went out. I drank like I was on a vengeance. I drank like they were going to run out and I was not going to be the last guy. And so Justin came down, he walks me around and he's introducing me to all these guys, takes me over to this long beard and he's like, "You know, this guy's tough. He's going to really work the steps with it. He's going to help get you through and you'll be fine." "Yeah, let's see. Work the steps. Working hard. Yeah. No, that's not for me. Thanks. Yeah. All right. Walks around. Next guy. This guy's very spiritual. He's going to guide you through all of this stuff. He's going to really teach you how to live life. How to learn how to live with your higher power. Higher power. Spiritual. Yeah, that's not going to work. No, thanks." Introducing me to about five other guys, and finally at the end of it, I'm like, "Yeah, I'll worry about the sponsor thing. Thanks, Justin, but you know, I'll keep coming back." And I did. So I went home that night and I talked to Bob, my den mother, and I said, "Bob, turns out I need a sponsor thing. Can you be a sponsor thing?" And he goes, "Yeah, I can be a sponsor thing." And so Bob started working the steps with me, gets me through, you know, makes me read the first 164. And we start working on step one, then we start working on step two, then we start working on step three. In the meantime, one of these guys getting time to start working on step four, one of the guys from the meeting, that big long gray beard guy, hands me this worksheet. He goes, "This will help you get through your fourth step." So I'm reading down the thing, it said something about farm animals, and I'm like, "Yep, we're not doing a fourth step, don't need one of those." Yeah, he had his fun, that was cool. So, anyways, I did a fourth step to the best of my ability at that time. That means that I didn't do it perfect. But I picked enough people to write it down in the first place, and I did as well as I could do with the knowledge that I had at the time. And I thought I did a great job, you know, and it didn't take the 4 years and 3 months and all of that stuff. Writing down my fourth step was easy for me. I already lived this thing. And a little weird time with that thing in the end of what was your part in all of this? You mean what was my part? I just told you why all these people wronged me, you know. But I had to sit down and really search that thing and, you know, wrote it all down and I finished up all of my stuff. And it comes time to do a fifth step. And I sat down with Bob and I told him most of the stuff. And I had a couple of things that weighed pretty heavy on me and things that I did that were pretty wrong, really wrong, really wrong. And so I wasn't going to tell Bob because I didn't really trust Bob with all of that stuff. I trusted him with most of it because I was willing to throw that stuff out with the trash anyways. And, you know, it took a few more times. I tried it with a priest. Sat down, you know, and I went through the whole thing and I couldn't tell him either. I came down to the end with the nuts and bolts and I couldn't tell him. And I held on those last couple of things for years. And I finally let go of them. I just had to find a guy just sick enough. I found the sickest son of a bitch I knew. And I told him. And he looked at me like, "Yeah, that's it." You know. anyways, finished all of that stuff. But I'm sitting inside of that meeting one night. I'm sitting outside the meeting. I'm having a cigarette afterwards, and this girl comes down, and she's like, "Can I talk to you for a few minutes?" And I'm like, and I'm thinking to myself, "Yeah, let's see, Casanova that I am, right? I'm living in a halfway house. I'm a great catch. I'm about ready to go to prison any moment now." And yeah, of course, come on down. So, and in the meantime, they had already told me, no relationships in the first year. I hear these guys crying about 6 months. You guys are pussies. No relationships for the first year. And I'm like, wow, okay. But that began my first no relationship with another female. And it was interesting, you know, it was kind of cool. We hung out, went to meetings, did this, did that, went out, dinners, all this stuff. But no relationship, man, no kiss at the end of the night. No nothing, no nothing, no nothing. Okay, fine, I survived that too. In the meantime, don't forget, I'm staying here and I got to go to court on these three DUIs. We go stand up in front of the judge and my counselor's sitting on one side of me. I've got some useless ass lawyer on the other side of me. I got a prosecutor over there that's yelling, 6 years, 6 years, 6 years. Sounds like a parrot. And I'm going, oh man. I don't know where my counselor stands up. Your Honor? This is not a man that just came in here to get three DUIs in 9 weeks. This is a sick man that needs help. He has a problem and he's never going to get any help in prison. And I'm gone. I'm going to prison. And the judge looks down at me and he's like, Mr. Livesey, today's your day. You can either do 6 months in this man's facility, another 6 months, and in which case you will do everything he says and you will come out of this place with flying colors. If you fail, you will do every day of 6 years. Or, and on top of that, I had to go do 1 year of county time in a DUI unit in work release. So let's see. Yeah, of course I took the deal. No brainer. So I get out of there, I complete everything. And the girlfriend and I are out shopping. I put her up in my apartment because I know I'm going to have to go back to jail for a little while. So, you know, I put her up in the apartment. And we get back and we're shopping for furniture. We get back and she hands me this little tiny piece of paper. And it's a little wadded up piece of paper. And the only thing I can relate to is a spit wad, right? I unfold this piece of paper and inside of it, it says, I'm pregnant. And the reason that she didn't want to tell me is because she knew that if she told me, I'd hit the door. Like, almost like that guy sitting back there right now. I'm just picking on it because he's right by the door, that's all. So, I got to tell you, it was like one of those happiest moments of my life. I couldn't speak. When I say speechless, I was speechless. I could not speak. I couldn't. I was like having a tough time breathing there for a moment. And it was insane. I have this thing like most alcoholics have. In the back of our heads, we have normal lives. You guys know what I'm talking about, right? The house, the picket fence, the car, the wife with the two kids and the two and a half dogs or whatever it is, you know. You have that thing in the back of your head. It's never coming true, but we have it in the back of our head. And, you know, it's always been there. I've always thought about those things. Just it's never going to come true. When your relationship lasts by the hour, those things don't happen. So, and, you know, it was one of those cool moments. But now I got to go do this jail time thing. And I go in there, and now all of a sudden I got to go through all of this stuff. Now I also got to get out of there in time because I got a kid coming out in the way, right? And just previous to going into jail, we'd both decided, you know, good alcoholics that we were, well, we're going to have a child. We should get married. And so we had this great big wedding, and we got all these bikers on one side of the room and all these blue-haired little old ladies on the other, and everybody's in the middle dancing, having a great time. Greatest, greatest wedding ever. I'm sitting up underneath this trellis thing, and my boss that had bailed me out three times, he married us, he was a notary public, and he sat there and married us, and it was fantastic. I'm sitting over there crying. On one side, she's laughing at me, on the other. But it was absolutely cool. So I go do this jail time thing, and I'm in there, who knew that if while you're in jail, you do a good job, and you go do your meetings, and you come back from work every day, and you're not trash, and you can blow into this thing, you get game time. I've been in jail tons of times. I never got any game time before. Never got out early. So, anyways, turns out I get out just in time because the baby's going to come in right before Christmas. Going to have my son for Christmas. Christmas goes by, no son. Okay, end of the year. Tax deduction, right? Right? End of the year comes around, it goes by, nothing. First of the year, New Year's baby. New Year's baby be cool, right? Nope, nothing. My belly button birthday is January 3rd. Great birthday present, right? Nothing. She calls me up after I went to work Monday morning, or that Monday the 4th, and she called me up and she goes, we're going to go in today and we're going to induce labor. I looked over at my boss and said, I got to go to work. I'm going to have a kid today. He goes, what do you mean you're going to have a kid today? I said, well, looks like we're having a kid today. He's like, okay. Quick gets me right off to the hospital. So we're sitting in there and they keep doing this stuff. And they're like, well, we can keep this up for 72 more hours. And she's like, no, we can't. And so she, okay, looks like we're having a baby today. So sitting in there they put this tent up around her head, and I'm sitting back here and I'm talking to the head. And my guys can't take a joke, right? So I'm sitting there talking to her, and all of this stuff's going on, and then I stood up. And once I stood up, now I can't sit down. So I sat there and watched a cesarean birth, and guys, there's absolutely nothing about a cesarean birth that we need to know whatsoever. It's the most disgusting thing I've ever seen in my life. My God, oh, it was awful. There's stuff everywhere, you know. They're pulling stuff out, just tossing it over here. Finally the baby comes out, and they bring the baby over to me, and they're like, Mr. Livesey, and I'm like, my son, and they're like, it's your daughter. Oops, forgot to put the stem on the apple. So I took her over, and I cleaned her all up, and the nurses are making sure that I'm doing everything. I'm counting fingers and toes, make sure they're all there, make sure they put that freaking low jack thing on. Nobody's getting away with my kid. Nobody. That low jack on, put the lock on that box too. Don't forget that either. It was one of the greatest moments of my life. I got to tell you, it was amazing. And the only thing that I can attribute all of this stuff to is that I came into the program. I stayed. I had one white chip. And I didn't give up. You know, I just stayed and life kept getting better. First year and a half in the program, so boy gets sober, boy meets girl, boy knocks up girl, boy has baby, boy buys a house, opens up a business, buys a brand new truck, builds a shovel head in his front living room, because guys build shovel heads, choppers in their living room. For those of you that don't know what a shovel head chopper is, it's a big, long, beautiful red motorcycle. Big bike. And everything was fantastic, you know. Welcome to Mike's Pink Cloud, baby, and I'm surfing that thing into the ground. And everything's fantastic. Coming home from work one day, and I get a phone call from her aunt. Her aunt's like, hey, you know, you got to go home. You got to turn on the TV and call his telephone number. So what are you talking about? So I go home and I turn on the TV. I call up this telephone number and they're like, it's the Cooper City Police Department. And I'm thinking, no, I didn't do anything wrong. I went to jail. I did all my stuff. You know, they're like, well, we'd like to come up and talk to you. Okay, what's this about? Well, we'll talk about it when we get up there. So then they come up to the house, bang, 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 and they're knocking on the door and stuff. And they're like, well, we'd like you to come down to the police station. We'd like to, you know, talk to you for a few minutes about some stuff. Some stuff? What kind of stuff? You know? Well, we'll talk to you about it when you get down there. And I'm like, and if I don't want to go? No, you have to go. Okay. Get back in the car with them, go down to the police station down there. They're walking me through this back aisle of desks and everything, and along the wall, there's all these pictures. They had found my wife murdered, stuffed inside of a suitcase, and left laying dead on the side of the road. And I sat there through 5.5 hours of interrogation because the husband did it. It's always the husband did it. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't think. At first I thought it was a joke. I didn't know what to do. And I'm sitting there and I'm just going through these things and all I can hear is noise. It's just noise. And I couldn't think. I had no idea what to do. They finally let me go outside and have a cigarette after a little while. There's a lady cop sitting next to me. And she's like, well, can I get you anything? Do you need anything? I want to go home. I want to go home. So that went on for about another hour. And then they let me go home. And I'm going back down to my buddy came and picked me up. We're going down the street to my house. And there's cars lined up all the way down my street, back up the other side. It goes all the way around the bend. Everybody that I ever met in AA, everybody that I knew, people that just knew us, anybody that was anybody that was everybody in AA was sitting at my house. Because when you need AA the most, it comes out in huge fashion. There was somebody there that cook for me, there was somebody there to clean for me, there was somebody there to watch the baby for me, there was somebody there to make sure I got up tomorrow morning, because maybe I don't want to get up tomorrow morning. I got up tomorrow morning and I went to work because I didn't know what else to do. AA did for me what I couldn't do for myself. Help me breathe. Because I couldn't breathe on my own, I couldn't think on my own, I was walking around in absolute daze. And at that point, I was mad at God. I was mad at AA. I was mad at everybody around me. I did everything I was supposed to do. I came, I stayed, I worked, I did. This isn't supposed to be happening to me. This is something you see on the news. This is not supposed to be happening to me. And I was just, I was outside screaming at the sky. I go to a meeting. They made me speak the next night. I went to another meeting afterwards. And then, I don't know if any of you people know Father Richard. I have this. He's now 93-year-old little Catholic priest sponsor. He's an absolute pistol. And I'm sitting there telling him about all of this crappy stuff and how bad everything is and God, why does he do this stuff? And I'm telling him I was standing in the backyard and I told him, you know, and he looked over at me and he's like, you selfish little bastard. Don't you realize God gave you everything? He gave you the time that you had with this woman so that you would know love for the first time in your entire life. He gave you a beautiful child. He gave you a home. He gave you a business to pay for all of this stuff in order to taking care of your family. He gave you everything, and you're sitting here snubbing at him over something that another man did. Another man did this to you. God is not vengeful. God does not want anything but the best for you. Another man did this. I hate him. I hate when he does stuff like that. Because he says stuff like that all the time, you know? And he was right, and it took me a long time to get that. He was right, though. You know, I was given every gift in the world. And who am I to look up at God and tell him what a crappy job he's doing? Who am I? I'm a guy that got everything in the world. I'm a guy that, you know, got married again afterwards. We'll call her plaintiff number two. Did manage to get my son out of the deal. That was kind of cool. I got a beautiful stepdaughter out of the deal that is my daughter. You can ask her dad. He'll tell you. He might be papa, but I'm dad. And she's a sweetheart. And today, I'm a grandpa. I got a two-year-old little granddaughter, and she's the absolute love of my life. That little kid just inside out makes me spend money like it's coming out of his mouth. 2 years old with a $5,000 bedroom suite. Yeah, baby, because that's what grandpas do. She's got a trike. She don't even know how to ride it. And you know what? Life is good.
Amen.
You know what? No matter what happens to you on this earth, no matter what happens to you in your daily life, no matter what kind of things go wrong, there is no need whatsoever to change your sobriety date. Only you can change your sobriety date. Nobody ever held me down and made me drink. Nobody ever made me do anything. The only person that can change my sobriety date is me. And so as long as I stay here and I do this deal, and I wake up every morning and I get to come out here to retreats with you guys. And by the way, thank you for hiding in the bushes and robbing us from our meetings so that you could get all the information you needed for yours. I thank you very much. Glad we could fill you with so much information. If you were sitting in our small group, in my small group, guys, I love you guys. And what an absolute extraordinary experience we had this week. This was amazing. There was some get down in the dirt stuff. And we all sat in there together and we hung in there and did it. And it was a great, great time. And no, I did not cry. Felt like it a couple of times, but I didn't do it. But, you know, it was great stuff. I've had an amazing time here this weekend with you guys, and I can't wait for the next one now. This is my first organized one, not like the bus tour kind of one I did before. You know, go down to the Keys and hang out by the pool with little plates with the girls walking by. That's right, my super next ex-wife date, you know? And it was amazing, and I can't wait to come and do it again. Thank you.